April 15th committee meetings, and I'll ask Region West to do a roll call.
Chair Bell.
Present.
Region Ball.
Present.
Region Brinkley.
Present.
Region Henson.
Present.
Region McKinney. Vice Chair Milken.
Present.
Region Nichols. Region Spiller.
Present.
Region Thomas.
Present.
Secretary West, I'm here.
Present.
Okay, Mr. Chair, we have 9 regions present, which represents a quorum of the board.
All right, and probably not a coincidence that it's April 15th and Region McKinney's not with us today. We'll give him a pass on that. Academic Affairs Committee will be the first committee, and I'll ask Chair West to proceed.
Thank you. We have a couple of action items on the agenda. The first is the approval of the supply chain management graduate certificate. And we have with us today, Provost Fisher is out of town today, but we have the Associate Provost for Faculty and Academic Excellence, Dr. Rob Hale.
Thank you, Chair West. I'd like to invite Dean Shook and Dana Coffey to come up and say a little bit about the supply chain management certificate and answer any questions.
Good morning, Chair West, Board of Regents. We appreciate this opportunity to seek your approval for this certificate. I have with me Dr. Dana Cosby, who is director of our MBA program. And when Dr. Cosby came to be the director of the MBA program, she took a very good look at what the community needed and the focus and where we could differentiate ourselves. And so this supply chain certificate is a key aspect of that. You'll be seeing some more certificates as we go through. But this is a part of a very modular MBA program. And so I'd invite you to ask Dr. Cosby and myself anything that you would like to know.
Seems in light of this new $2 billion investment that's going to come into Bowling Green, as announced by our governor last week, that yes, this is a most timely situation, and it looks like this is just a great time for such a program.
It is, and did you want to talk about the research you did briefly?
Okay, so we started looking into this a couple of years ago, actually. It got ahead of the curve. And supply chain is such a dynamic, ever-changing industry right now that we knew that to be able to support the industry in this area by skilling and reskilling as this market grows, this would be very critical to the future success of economic development in our community. And so we stand ready to do that at Gordon-Ford College of Business.
Wonderful idea.
It feels almost patriotic in today's times.
Professor Crosby, can you talk a little bit about, because I think this is one of the innovations around the MBA program that's going to be quite marketable, the stackable nature of certificates and how y'all reconceptualize the MBA?
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm preaching to the choir if I say that, you know, business is changing it at a more rapid speed than ever. And so what we're seeing in the workforce is that we have tremendous need to allow employees and working folks and even students coming out of school to respond to those changes very quickly. And so we have adopted a stackable program with our MBA program. So for example, students that are interested in the cybersecurity area, the data analytics area, they can obtain the reskilling or skilling that they need very rapidly in a shorter time frame. And then, as life permits, they can decide to gain another credential that will eventually lead to a graduate degree, either a master's in science or an MBA. And so what that does is it allows people to advance their career path, their career journey, support the needs of industry in a way that makes sense for today's time.
I preface my question with full disclosure in the management area, industry has been coming to me for a while and saying it desperately needs students, there's graduates who can do this, which I would also point out, we have a supply chain concentration coming out in management that will come online in August as well. So we, as Dr. Cosby said, we have been ahead of this. And it's not just the latest investment being made, but others have been looking for this as well. But, you know, one of the things that we're competing with now, is, as the president has said, is these people who, students, prospective students who can get jobs right now working in a factory. Okay, but if they get a certificate from us, or for the undergraduate concentration, or the graduate certificate from us, what kind of earning potential do people in supply chain management have? What are we talking about here? What are you hearing from the industry?
Okay. You know, our research indicates that these are very high-paying jobs. And they're high-paying jobs today, and they will be well into the future. But what we have to keep our focus on is the agility of matching what is going to be needed with what we're doing. And, for example, if you look back in 2017 at job descriptions, job postings, Gartner found that 33% of those skills that were needed in 2017 are not needed today. So there are new skills. And so with the stackable certificate programs, being very agile in those credentials, we think that we're doing a lot to advance the interests of our region and of our constituents and students.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any more questions?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Do we have a motion to approve the supply chain management certificate?
So moved.
Any second?
Second.
Any further discussion? Call for a vote. Then all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, like sign. The motion passes. Thank you all. We have another action item too, and that is the approval of emeritus appointments. And Dr. Hale, do you want to speak to that?
Sure. We have two emeritus nominations, one faculty emeritus and one staff emeritus. The faculty emeritus nomination is for Dr. James Gary, who is an associate professor in engineering and applied sciences. Dr. Gary began his academic career at WKU back in 98. He served in various roles, including department chair, and taught a wide variety of courses to support the programs. That's Dr. Gary. Dr. LaDonna Hunton is somebody I know well. She was the Associate Vice President for Finance and Academic Affairs. And Dr. Hunt began her career back in 2000. She served as Budget and Accounting Analyst until 2005, Manager for Academic Budgets until 2001, Director of Academic Resource Allocation until 2012, and Associate VP for Academic Budgets Administration until her retirement in 21. She served every provost this century with distinction. She was a very thoughtful mentor to folks in our office, including me. I can't think of anybody that served Western with more extreme confidence, and I do mean extreme confidence and care. And so I'm happy to bring both of those nominations to you.
Thank you.
Does
anybody have any questions? They both sound very accomplished, Dr. Gary and Dr. Hunton. And I'm going to ask for a motion to approve the emeritus appointments.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Any further discussion? Okay. All in favor of the approval of the emeritus appointments, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Motion passes. And Dr. Hale, we have an information item that I think you're going to speak to regarding the name change of the Department of Information Systems to Department of Analytics and Information Systems.
I really don't have much for you on this one. I think it's marketing, right? And it's right. Really what's happening with information systems. Analytics is what's going on in the world. And, you know, like Dr. Cosby said, we've got to stay on top what's happening, you know, in the industry, in the world. And so I think this is a move to be more specific and about what's going on in that program and to help market it better. You want to add anything, Dean Shook?
I would add, I'm very excited to hear an English PhD talk about marketing. but beyond marketing, it also reflects better the changing nature of the courses and degree over time. So,
yeah, I sold my soul a couple of years ago.
Good to hear.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Hale.
Rob, I think the new name is a little more poetic than the old.
Close.
Okay. I am going to, since Jason McKinney.
I was going to make one comment before we move to finance and budget, which Regent West has been so kind to also agree to chair in Regent McKinney's absence. But I think it's nice if we can have the emeriti, if it doesn't inconvenience them, to come to our meeting. I love putting faces to names. I don't expect all of them to get up and perform as our last one did, which was fantastic. Dr.
Cipollino.
Yeah. Anyway, he gave us a great performance. But if it doesn't inconvenience them and they can be here, I think it's great if we can see them and put a face to a name. It might be appropriate, information-wise, too, to just shout out to our online bachelor program. Got some really good news recently, I think. Number one in the state.
Number 35 in the country, yes. Yeah. So just recently, new U.S. News and World Report rankings were released, and while we had many graduate programs recognized for excellence, our online programs were ranked to the highest of any institution in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and in the top 50, 35th in the country, to be precise, nationally. So a good bit of recognition for us. That's in my I will repeat this in my president's report at the full meeting in May, I agree with having our emeriti faculty come visit. We'll do that at the we'll have them at the full convening, the full vote in May. If that works.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry to have interrupted, but we will now move to the Finance and Budget Committee. West.
Thank you. So we have two action items on the agenda for the Finance and Budget Committee today. The first one is the approval of personnel actions. Susan, how would you speak to that?
Sure.
Jeff, is PowerPoint?
Okay.
They're loading up my few slides that I have. There we go. So. So overall, another good quarterly report for the university as far as finances. Looking first at revenues, you can see that we are tracking very closely with last year. Last year, we were at 88% of the total budget. This year, we're a little over that, 89% of the total budget. Moving to the specifics within the revenue, our net tuition revenue is trending slightly below budget at this time. Now, if you remember right, I said at our first quarterly report that we were trending slightly below budget, so we actually held back some contingency from the carry forward, about $8 million, to cover any potential shortfall that we had. So $8 million is going to be more than enough because what we saw in the fall to spring retention was excellent. It might have been record-breaking as far as what we've ever seen. So the $8 million is going to be more than enough to cover the shortfall in tuition revenue. So grants and contracts, that's significantly higher than the prior year, primarily because all the federal state CARES funding. The other revenue is up as well, primarily because of the resumption of campus operations and programs. Any questions on revenue before I move to expenditures? Okay. So in expenditures, I think that this is excellent news. Our direct expenditures are slightly higher than the prior year, and primarily because of equipment is up, but that's due to reimbursable COVID-related purchases and student financial aid related to direct reimbursements to our students. All other expense categories are tracking in line with budget and should come on target for the fiscal year. If you look at personnel expenditures and you think about if you looked at the report, this is really great news for campus because our salaries are almost $2 million lower than last year. And if you remember last year, we had central control. And we took out the central control and we passed it on to the deans and vice presidents. So they're still doing an excellent job controlling salaries. Unfortunately, fringe benefits are up by about $2 million, and that's directly related to the increase in KERS. So overall, it's in line with where we were last year. Any questions on anything in the revenues or expenditures?
If you could go back one just to the revenues, Ms. President, if you have any statements or thoughts on the net tuition revenue.
Yeah, I do. I think that it's important to think about what our long-term strategy is. We have a new scholarship model that was put in place a few years ago, and the success of that is predicated on enrollment stabilization and then growth. Unfortunately, in the middle of that, we had COVID-19. We were on path to grow. We had an outlier year, which I would say is fall 20, and then 21 went back to trend. And so I think that if you look at what we've done, we've managed to take our budget numbers, which were high, and bring them in line with our revenue numbers, which is close, and bring that in line with our expenditure numbers. So essentially, instead of us having large budgets that don't reflect reality, we have real budgets that reflect projections. And, you know, I would say that with the $350 million budget, 1 or 2% variation in revenue is pretty typical. The discount rate was designed to go up. We had a little bit of over-awarding, I would say. And that's, in some ways, a good thing for FTE, but challenging on the revenue side. What happens eventually is in years 3 and 4, and I think we'll talk about this in depth at the retreat of the scholarship model, what you wind up with is growing enrollment, net tuition revenue, while a little bit, per student a little bit lower, the overall growth in revenue is there. The last thing I'll say we have to do, we talked about undergraduate revenue. If you disaggregate these numbers, we have to do better on graduate enrollment, period. I've been very clear about that in several meetings. If you look at our international student enrollment, beginning in 2015, when the decline actually began, we've gone through approximately a $20 million revenue shortfall. And so what we're doing is we're rebalancing. And on the other side, as we work through the budget executive committee and planning for the 2023 budget, the good news is that we have gotten to a place where our budgets are stable. We're beginning to have hopefully some reward for colleges that have done hard work around efficiency and effectiveness. And you're going to see that when we get to the full budget in June. A great question, though.
Well, I appreciate hearing about being more proactive on the graduate program. The last two things we've approved here, the graduate program, graduate certificate, and as you know, in graduate education, and I know there's a lot of opportunity there just as part of an overall enrollment strategy. So I do appreciate hearing that.
I think what you're going to begin to see, and Bud is not here, so I'm talking a little bit out of school, but in my conversations with him, and I think the deans will back me up on this, you're going to see a devolution of control to colleges and deans and trying to get some of the bureaucratic holdup at the center out of the way. The deans are all laughing and clapping silently.
Any other questions or statements? We have a motion to accept for filing the statement of revenues and expenditures for the 9 months ending March 31st, 2022 and 2021. Second. Any further discussion? Right, we'll move to a vote on the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes.
Chair, may I add one comment?
Sure.
I forgot to say this because my head exploded when I saw the first pass of numbers. Revenue number for, and Susan knows this, and everyone who got dragged into the conference room knows this. The revenue number for the third quarter does not include additional tuition revenue that comes in over the summer and some other revenues as well. So while the revenue number is down year over year, you're comparing a third quarter number to total revenue, essentially.
So to that point, we expect probably $7 to $8 million additional dollars in tuition revenue for the summer.
All right, and we have another action item. It's actually listed as FB1 on the agenda, and it's an approval of personnel actions.
So again, these are the standard personnel actions and one-time payments. On the personnel actions, it runs from January 1 through March 20th, and the one-time compensation from January 1 through March 31st. I'm going to tell you my question to my HR folks is that why are the dates different? And it's the answer that I don't typically like, that we've done it like that for a long time now. So I'm going to get those in line next year so that there's not this differencing of dates. So they're standard. I met with David and Shane earlier this week, and no questions came up at that point. So I'll take any questions if there's any specific questions.
Just briefly, since I know I'll be asked at some point, looking through all of these, I'm wondering if Stuart could comment on the football salaries and the adjustments in there. Just overall, last meeting you talked about the overall strategy on managing those salaries, and just if you could repeat that or restate that, since there's a number of those here.
Yes, sir. Happy to. So the way that we work with football is, the good part about football is we're having success. The I don't want to say the bad part of that, but the reaction to that is coaches leave for other jobs. And so we tend to have a lot of turnover in football. What our head coach, Tyson Helton, has done a very good job of is hiring really good young people and developing them on his staff so that when we lose people, more times than not, we promote from within. So what he has done, and other coaches do this as well, but what he has done is the total spending on salaries does not change, but he'll promote people from within. And their salary will change in some cases dramatically because their responsibilities change dramatically. But then the people that replace them oftentimes make less than maybe even what that person made. So again, the total spending is the same, but you do see quite a variance among some people, particularly those that were already here and were promoted within.
Thank you.
I have a follow-up, if that's all right. So when we talk about total spending in an area like in athletics, it's logical that you have a certain amount that you target to fulfill with salaries based on market-driven issues. Would it be possible, and I'm, you know, to Susan's comment of the way we've done it in the past, there's an awful lot of detail on these personnel action reports. When departments, colleges, areas really just work within their own budgets. Does the Board of Regents, is there a statutory requirement for all of the names to be listed along with every position, or is that just the way we've done it in the past? I guess this question is for Andy.
There's a statutory requirement that you approve all compensation. So I don't know that the report has to have the level of detail that ours does, but I would argue that yes, the names of the compensation has to be approved.
Any other questions?
I will
will say, I'm not sure if this is a change or not, but sorting by magnitude of change in salary by the delta, I think, is helpful. So that, I mean, instead of having to look through every $500 stipend, that you can, the large changes jump out and folks can target their attention there, which I think is what happens anyway. And so I, while I appreciate they're all in there, we may be able to say, you know, we can see the anything over a certain threshold. I think that's worthy of a conversation, that we separate that out so that we can focus in on it.
Any other questions? Okay, do we have a motion to approve the personnel actions?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Motion passes. And I believe that's all the business of the Finance and Budget Committee.
Thank you, Regent West, for filling in so ably with Regent McKinney. And that brings us to the Executive Committee, and we have a couple of action items. The first concerns construction of some athletic facilities, so Todd will keep you on the floor.
Good morning again, and thank you for the opportunity to be with you. Our soccer and softball programs currently are performing at a very high level, arguably collectively as well as they have in their respective histories. Both won conference championships in 2021. Softball is currently in first place in Conference USA this year. Softball went to the NCAA tournament last year, and that performance from soccer and softball is really pretty consistent over the last few years. So, but while they have grown and really progressed on the field of play, what has not kept up with that are the facilities that they reside in and train in on a daily basis. And specifically what I would tell you, and then I'll walk you through this, is that our softball program, while their facility that they play games at in practice is over by parking structure PS3, their locker room is in Diddle Arena, and our soccer program, their field is adjacent to the softball program, and their locker room is in the football stadium. And what I have in front of you, pending your approval today, is a project that we will put out to bid shortly and begin construction on this summer. But it, essentially what it is it becomes a permanent home for soccer and softball on game day, and just greatly enhances their current situation. So that's right there is the view from Creason, what it would look like on the outside. The soccer field is on the other side of that, and the softball field is to the right of that, if you want to switch it to the second one. And you know what, that's the view really from the soccer field. But what this really does is we're just really deficient in this area here. I mean, if you think about it, it is not an exaggeration when I say that our players, our softball and our soccer players, if they need to use the restroom facilities on game day, they have to go to the same area the general fans go to, and so do the officials. And they have nothing on site in terms of the ability to change clothes, shower, meet, none of that. That all, the softball team does everything in their dugout. Soccer team does everything on their field. So what this does is, again, it just gives them a site to reside at from a locker room standpoint and train. You can put the next one up if you don't mind. Here's probably more detail than you need, but this is the actual schematics of what it would look like. And it will be a great facility for both, because on the far left, what you have is an indoor training area. And right now, softball and baseball have to share an indoor area with hitting facilities. So softball would have their own in here. Soccer could also use that to train. Obviously, that's not nearly as large as a soccer field would be, but it still gives them an ability to do a number of things indoors that they currently can't do. But softball We would have three hitting cages that are easily, they're mobile, that can be set up and pulled back very easily. They can hit in there. They can also take infield. So it just gives them an indoor area to train, which, as we all know, January and February can be unpredictable here from a weather standpoint. So that would be very helpful for them on that. And then, again, you just see not only do they have a locker room and coaches' offices, but there's a training room there. You know, any medical service that either program needs right now during their game is done out in the open, you know, for everybody to see. So here's a private room for medical treatment. Again, you talk about student athlete welfare. This is just a huge improvement over what we currently have. That is also an area for the officials to go to. You know, the officials are kind of exposed right now. They don't have anywhere to go to before, during, or after the game. So it's really a win for everybody. And then the last facility, or I'm sorry, the last slide, that's the view that our athletes would see when they come in. And, you know, again, just softball to be dressing in Diddle Arena, which is really not very close to their field. And they make it work. I mean, they haven't complained about it at all, but I just think that the success of both these programs is such that they just deserve a better situation from their current accommodations, and that's what this would provide. Happy to take any questions.
For the record, just address the budgetary implications, if you will, please.
Yeah, yes. So we'll put this out to bid in a few weeks, so I don't have exact numbers. We anticipate this being around a $3 million project, perhaps a little less, perhaps a little more, but it will all be paid for primarily by using the exit fees that we will receive from the departing members of Conference USA. And in the event that that doesn't totally cover it, the Hilltopper Athletic Foundation is totally on board with covering some as well. So we won't have to take a loan out. There won't be any state money used. It'll all be paid for from those two areas, but primarily from the exit fees.
Any questions?
A comment, if I may. First, I appreciate Todd pointing out that this is a facility that is not a renovation of what are the relatively recent softball facilities. This is new and something that's necessary. The month where we're celebrating Title IX, I think this goes a long way to help address some of the inequities that we see. It's necessary here on our campus so that we support our female student athletes. And the last is, I just have a strong recollection of my first fall on the Hill when it was senior night for the soccer team. And after their match was over, watching these young women have to get into a presentable condition in their dugout in front of fans is not something that's acceptable for our institution. So I just urge you all to vote for this. I think it's necessary, it's important. And if we can take something good out of all of the difficulties of conference realignment and use these one-time dollars to help get our young women the facilities they deserve, that we should do that. The last thing related to the age of the facilities, there was a comment online about renovating 15-year-old facilities, and our art facilities are 40 years old. I'm happy to say that we're going to have some resources from the state available to help with challenged spaces all across our academic units, and you'll hear more about that in a little bit, but understand that we have about $500 million in deferred maintenance on this campus, and we are working hard to address that each year, but we're going to have some additional funds available this year.
Any other questions or comments?
One thought, we'll build it with one-time money, but there will be maintenance costs. How significant might they be going forward? I'm looking at Brian Russell.
I'd like the opportunity to get back with you on the exact amount of what it would cost for M&O. I don't have it.
Any other questions?
I think this is a facility we need. That's just the bottom line.
Any other comments, questions? If not, for our committee members, I'll ask for a motion.
So moved.
Motion from Regent West.
I'll second.
Second from Regent Henson. Any other discussion, comments? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Thank you, Todd.
Thank you. And our soccer and softball programs, thank you.
Our next item concerns request for approval of Provost Emeritus for Dr. Cheryl Stevens.
Chair Bale, I will address this one. Regents, it's my privilege, my pleasure to ask for you to approve an emeritus status, Provost Emeritus status for Dr. Cheryl Stevens. As you well know, Dr. Stevens was on the Hill with us for almost a decade, serving as dean, first as Dean of Ogden College of Science and Engineering, beginning in 2012 through March of 2019. In addition to that, she served other leadership roles, including the Research Foundation and Director of Applied Research and Technology Program, both of which continue to be important for our university's success. From my perspective, she did a wonderful job leading our science programs, especially in areas of encouraging women participation in engineering. So our WISE program for young engineers really designed to attract additional gender equity into the engineering program, and I know she's very proud of that. But my time was really spent with her as interim provost, and she had about 6 months to figure out what the job was, and then COVID hit, and she was a remarkable partner as we worked through an unimaginable challenge. And so for that, I will always be thankful for Cheryl's good partnership and leadership. She helped us transition essentially overnight into virtual instruction in the spring of 20, and then navigated with the faculty the remainder of the pandemic. I know we're still in the pandemic, but we're at the tail end of it. But she was a great help and stepped into that role at a time when there was terrific uncertainty on the campus, and helped our faculty be certain in our forward direction. So with that, it's my honor, my privilege to recommend that you approve Cheryl Stevens be awarded Provost Emeritus status.
Any comments? Discussion? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
Motion from Regent West.
I second.
Second from Regent Henson for approval of Provost Emeritus for Dr. Cheryl Stevens. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Like sign. Motion passes. All right. Information legislative update. The legislature finished their work last night. What time did they finish? It's usually midnight.
It was earlier than normal. It was like 8 o'clock.
Really?
Well, 8 o'clock for us, 9, 10 up there, somewhere around that. So, yeah, I wasn't up as late as I normally am on the last day. Yeah, they did that once, and I got in trouble for that. I'm not allowed to do that anymore.
All right. Well, you would be so kind to give us the latest
Absolutely. Stuff. So, I thought it might be helpful for you all to know, this was my 14th legislative session working at WKU and advocating for our for higher education and our efforts. And it was also the first year that there was a substantial investment in higher education. So, it took me 13 years, 14 sessions to get there, so hopefully it won't be another 14 before we have additional investment. But so I will start out with House Bill 1, which was the executive branch budget. Higher education looks wonderful. They added an additional $97.3 million in each year of that biennium to performance funding, so we will get to compete for those funds. So, and I'm going to talk a little bit about House Bill 8 from last year in a minute, but one of the things that House Bill 8 from last year did, it changed our, and Susan mentioned this, it changed our employer contribution to the Kentucky Employee Retirement System. And so part of what House Bill 8 did was it did a schedule of a pension subsidy, basically, that the state will give us to help cover the increase in those costs. And so they were, this was the year it was supposed to go down by 10% every year. This year it was supposed to start at 90% and then 80% in the second year. they instead delayed that by a year. So the first year of the biennium, we will still get 100% of that pension subsidy. And then in the second year of the biennium, we get 90%. So that was also very helpful. So LifeWorks at WKU will receive $2.8 million from the State Fiscal Recovery Fund of the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021. So that's one-time funds to go into LifeWorks to help grow scholarships and things like that that are available for them, for those students that participate in that program. The Kentucky Mesonet is receiving an additional $1 million to their state appropriation, so they will now be receiving from the state about $1.75 million. I already had one legislator come to me and say, can I get a station in my county? And I said, absolutely, we will make that happen. and I think, I mean, I certainly don't want to speak too much on behalf of the Mesonet, but I think we're at 80 stations right now, and our goal was 100. So I think this will definitely help us get to those goals that we had originally set when the Mesonet was created. Okay, so an additional $10 million was put into the Bucks for Brains program just for the comprehensive universities. There's a separate fund for the research institutions. So we will be able to compete for those funds. So that's everything that just goes into kind of the maintenance or just our day-to-day business.
How long has it been since we had Bucks for Brains?
I don't know. I don't know that we've had it since I've been here. Maybe they did it in 2010. But we've talked about it for years and years and years, and they've just never funded it. Right now, there's a surplus of funds, so it's good that we're able to benefit from that, and that they saw that putting those funds into higher education was the right thing to do. So for those extra funds that they have right now. So do you have any questions about that before I move on to capital?
How much money did the 1 year and not having to fund the pension 100%, how much did that save us? Susan, you may know that off the top of your head.
I do not know off the top of my head.
It's approximately $500,000.
Just curious.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Sorry.
He knows this stuff so well. You know, it's like I sleep and I forget some of it.
Yeah.
Sure. So, yeah.
Can I ask a question to this committee? Jennifer, you mentioned, and by the way, thanks. You all are called Bulls, right?
We are Bulls, yeah. Yes. We're the Bulls.
I think you're the best of all the ones in Kentucky. I just want to say that out loud. But I want to go back to the Mesonet just briefly. And so the Mesonet's largely funded by this state appropriation, which we know state appropriations are notoriously difficult to get. And that's a substantial increase annually. You know, when I think about ways through ENG and our federal funding for public media, we are able to employ 40 to 45 students every year throughout the semester and the working semester. I'm assuming that more students could be hired for a valuable applied learning experience tied directly to WKU through the Mesonet with this additional money. Do you think that's logical?
I do. I mean, I certainly can't speak for the Mesonet, but I think that would be part of what those applied centers are for. So I would think so.
Dave Brown is not here, but I will talk a little bit about that in his absence. There's currently a search in progress for the director of the Mesonet. There's an interim director and interim state climatologist in place who is doing an able job. But I do think that as we've had conversations around the Mesonet and the way in which it engages with and alongside the college and the meteorology program and the climate study activities of our young people, there is an additional role for applied learning for young people who are undergraduates and graduate students. Much of the Mesonet's work today is conducted by professional staff, but given the size of this investment, and the direction that Dean Brown is taking Ogden, I would be surprised if there weren't additional student slots and applied learning experiences created through the investment.
It was just I noticed the amount and thought, goodness, what we can do with even $150,000, $170,000 each year is tremendous with students, so I would hope that that focus would go there. Thanks, I appreciate it. Yes.
Any other questions before I move on to capital? So I will start off with, the president alluded to this earlier about some of the deferred maintenance across the campus. The state gave us $34 million in each year to address what they're calling asset preservation, so deferred maintenance across campus. The comprehensive universities have to match that at 15%. So for us, that's roughly $10 million. That we will have to match that with, but we have been trying for many years to get these asset preservation dollars. The House actually put it in the budget in 2020, and it was over in the Senate, and I think the Senate was probably going to do the same, and then the world shut down, and they did a one-year budget and didn't add anything extra to that, not knowing what the economy was going to look like. So it's very exciting that they have now included those funds in there for us so we can start addressing some of these issues we have across campus. Hopefully that means you're not raining in your office anymore, Regent Spiller.
I think there's another plan.
Yes, sir. Oh, yeah. Is it 34 million?
So
yes.
15% of that would be 10 million.
No,
maybe it's 10 million total. 10 million total. I'm sorry.
Over the 2 years.
Yeah, over the 2 years. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, over 2 years.
Yes, over the 2 years.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Good. And they're also, just to add a bit of complexion to that, the legislature also approved bonding authority for us to be able to bond out that $10.5 million if we needed it. But we already are making significant investments in deferred maintenance across the campus. When it's a $500 million total, $10 million a year does not go very far, so this will give us a bit of a jump. I'm hopeful we will not need to use that bonding authority, but if we do, it's there for us for that match.
And I will say, I know this doesn't really affect us, but so where the comprehensives have to come up with a 15% match, the research institutions have to come up with 30%. So that was very nice that they helped us out in that way. Yes.
As I understand, we're talking 34 million change for each year of the bond.
Correct. Yes.
And then the 15% would be for each year as
right.
well.
Right. Right. So okay. It's like five.
I just want to be sure.
Five year.
So
yeah.
If you add it all up, it's approximately $80 million of investment in fixing stuff. Now, I will turn around and look at Brian Russell, because Brian Russell will tell you that we could spend every dollar of that and you wouldn't notice anything on campus, because it could go to HVAC systems, steam tunnels, roofing, and other water challenges that we have. And so I know folks are excited about the prospect of seeing things in their space. We're going to have to be strategic and intentional about it. At the same time, we have a master plan that talks about facilities that are highly trafficked that have significant use, and we're going to have to do some work there as well, just as a bit of a preview to what comes. But
Brian,
yes.
Do you have any other comment? Can tell you, like this summer, we are releasing almost $1 million in STEAM projects. We always tell people, they say we get that little break in Christmas time. We have to have everything ready, and the day after commencement, we are hitting the ground running with our contractors. This is going to be an extremely busy summer again. It is not unusual for us to do several million dollars worth of work. We're staging right now to do Dill Arena roof. We're staging right now to do IEB roof, which is industrial education building. We've got Steamline projects. There's 9 locations on campus that must be repaired so that we're ready for operation next year. There will be boilers replaced. It's just a tremendous amount of things that happen across our campus. We also have a big roof we've been delaying out at the South Campus, and it's significant work that will be done as we move forward. Sounds like a lot of money, but we've got a lot of really good places to put it. Our goal is to keep the campus operational, and continuous improvement is what we do.
So last but finally not least, the capital project is $74.4 million for a new Baltimore College of Business. So that is very exciting. Building. Yes, building. Sorry. We're going to keep you.
Okay, thanks.
That's very exciting. The last capital project that we received from the state was Ogden College Hall, and that was in, I think, either 14 or 16. So it's been a long time since we've had a capital project. So
and that was $48 million.
And that was $48 million. At the time, that was going to be a renovation and ended up having to be a new building. So very exciting. Any questions about the budget before I move on? So just a few other pieces of legislation that were passed. House Bill 663 was about financial disclosures at the universities. Basically what this does is it just says that from now on going forward, the chair of the board plus the president has to sign off on those financial statements. This just stems from some of the issues that have happened at Kentucky State, and so now they just want to make sure that everybody knows what the finances look like and that we're all doing okay. So then House Bill 668, this is the one that is connected to House Bill 8 from last year. So this is a pension bill, and so what House Bill 8 did, part of what it did, is it required the quasi-governmental agencies and the universities to grow our KERS employee base, okay? So any KERS employees, those are any positions that do not require a bachelor's degree. So one of the, it required us to grow the base to be able to remain, to be able to keep our pension subsidy that they outlined in House Bill 8 that I talked about a few minutes ago. So what we did with this bill is it exempted certain services. Basically, those non-core business services, grounds crew, dining, building services, attendance, maintenance, that sort of thing. It basically said, we're going to exempt all of these from the calculation to determine the pension subsidy. Does that make sense?
If this had not passed,
it meant that we would have had to increase our KERS employee base by roughly 200 employees by 2024 to keep our pension subsidy. And as you can imagine, I think that would be a very difficult task. And when you look at the employer contribution that we pay right now to KERS, it's 75%. Of each one of those employees' salary. That's just to the pension system. That does not include all the rest of the fringe benefits. And so so what this did is it exempted those with, and President Cavani testified in front of the Public Pension Oversight Board about this issue and did a fantastic job. But just basically saying, you know, we have not outsourced our core business. And I think that was some of the quasi-governmental agencies have, but the universities have not. And that was our biggest argument about why we needed this, is that, you know, we have gone into some of these third-party partnerships to be better stewards of the money that the state gives us. And so this fixed that.
I'll go a little bit farther than Jennifer and Mike. That testimony was enjoyable for me. Some of you know we've had a bit of a contentious relationship with the public pension system, particularly one of the fellows that leads it, who also was testifying, and it gave us the opportunity to demonstrate what we've done strategically, why we've done it, and why the way in which they're trying to manipulate the statutes to actually just increase dollars going through the pension system are antithetical to what we need to be doing in higher education, which is trying to figure out as many ways as we can to save costs, reduce expenditures, and focus on our core business instead of being all things for all operations. And so I think it resonated, and I relished the opportunity to testify.
I enjoyed that so much. I just sat back there and I was like, he's doing so great. But one of the things that was actually in House Bill 8 is it talked about a historical employee. So if any position had ever historically been employed by the university at any point in time, they were going to count that against us if that position no longer exists here, but say someone at Aramark now has a position that was similar. So, I don't know, work in the register at Fresh Food Company, for instance. And, you know, that was one of the questions that they asked to the KERS employees was, well, when you talk about historical, where are you going? And they were like, well, when they joined the pension system. We're not the same university we were when we joined the pension system, and things are very different now. And so that, I think, that helped us in our argument about why we need to exempt very specific services. And so all of the universities that are in the pension system, we all work together on this. And so it was definitely a team effort. And Representative Duplessis and Representative Tipton were real champions in the House, and they fought hard for us on this one. So
since we're talking about outsourcing, I do also want to comment, because I don't want it to be taken as a negative. We work very hard and with our partnerships, and have pressed those partners to hire folks and do salary increases that gets those employees to a place where they have a livable living wage. And we've made some good strides this year. We're continuing to do that. But I didn't want anyone to think that it's an outsourcing in such a way that is harmful to employees or folks that those companies hire. They've actually done a really nice job getting those salaries up, and are going to continue to work on that, as we all are, given the context in which we're working.
Chairman, I just want to, this is, maybe it's unclear to me or maybe it's too obvious, I just want to make sure. You talk about 200 additional positions under KERS, 75%. If we fund those at a $30,000 position, just picking a number, right? That's $4.5 million when you do that math out over 200 positions. We know that $4.5 million is 2% of additional pay for everybody on campus. I mean, right, roughly. I mean, that would preclude us as a board from being able to authorize additional money for existing employees, because we had to add this pension liability to other areas. Is that?
I mean, so you'll remember,
that's a lot of money.
I don't. You will remember in the spring of 2018, which I care not to remember very closely, the challenge that we faced around budget pressures. And one of the challenges we faced was a pension system that was eating away at the budget and any budget growth, to the place where it was almost impossible to grow salary increases, because any increase in revenue was being taken up by KERS and KTRS increases, increasing at an exponential rate. You can't find any organization in this nation that has a fringe benefit rate that's 150% that's sustainable. And it is a challenge for our state. I know we've made commitments and have to deliver on those commitments, but doing it on the backs of universities and in turn on families and students is really not the way we need to fix the pension system.
And one of the things that they did with House Bill 8 is they took what the unfunded liability is for each university and quasi-governmental agency, and they amortized it over 30 years. Instead of every session we're going in not knowing what our KERS employer contribution rate is going to be, you know, and they were great that they froze it at 49% for several years, but it was scheduled to go up to as high as 86%. So we're very very lucky in the fact that we're only having to do 75 when you look at what it could have been. I think it probably would have gotten over to over 100% had they not passed House Bill 8 last year. So.
Thanks for putting that into some more context, real dollars.
Yeah.
So. Okay, no other questions about that. I will move on very quickly. There's just a couple more things. May have talked with you all about this already. Senate Bill 6 was the name, image, and likeness bill is what they're calling it. So it's, you know, for student athletes to be able to be compensated. That was signed into law by the governor a couple months ago. Senate Bill 10 has to do with nursing. Basically what this bill does is it gives us flexibility as to who can teach our nursing courses. However, we will continue to follow our accreditation standards as far as all of that goes. But the point of that bill is to try to get more nurses trained in on the hospital floors and in the healthcare settings. And then our final two things are our Senate resolutions that confirm Regent Bell and Regent Thomas to the board. So they did that, you know, of course, very end last night, and I'm just like, hurry up, come on, I need you to confirm them. So those
were
the...
I went to bed early.
Yeah. Well, I was up watching for you, don't worry. So that's it. So if you all don't have any other questions, that's my report.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
If I could maybe just make one comment. David mentioned, Richard Brinkley mentioned the university advocates in Frankfurt. Jennifer leads that group for the Commonwealth and all of our universities, has done an incredibly able job this year. I'm thankful that she's in the role. I'm thankful she's in that role in particular, and has really kept higher education on a great path this session. And what she did not talk about are the dozens of bills on which we played defense that did not see the light of day and for which I'm quite thankful. But it was not an easy session, and keeping all the different university perspectives in line was a challenge, but she did a great job. So I echo Rick's comment.
Yes, we're lucky to have Jennifer there on our behalf.
She's a real
Before we go to the Student Affairs Committee, let me just recognize Linda and George have been with us for our meeting, and even though they have been quiet, George uncharacteristically quiet today, it's great having you all with us in any form that you can, and thank you for all your input during meetings and outside of meetings. So. Does anyone need to take a break? Are we good? Great. If the old guys are good, everybody.
How come you punched me?
No.
I think he was looking over here.
We'll move right on to the Student Affairs Committee then, and Chair Henson.
Thank you, Dr. Bale. We have Student Affairs Committee has two information items. First one is an update on the recruitment and retention. And Dr. Logan, would you like to take this over?
Yes, thank you, Chair Henson. I appreciate that. And members of the board, good morning. I have two items today for the Student Affairs Committee. The first is an enrollment update to kind of keep everybody abreast of where we are with the progress we're making towards fall 2022 and what we're looking like for this year's recruitment cycle. I'll provide kind of an overview, and if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to interrupt. This is aggregate funnel comparison. This is kind of where we usually start conversations to look at where we're performing. You'll see a lot of consistency in the way that we approach our funnel development. So top of funnel is where we're looking at lead development and trying to find students and provoke students' interest in the institution. As we move down the funnel, inquiries are those students who've expressed interest, applications submitted to the institution versus completed, those that have completed the process of an application to the institution. That's not just applying, but that's also providing transcripts and all the steps that make a student reviewable for admission, the admissions of students. And so when you see where we are versus 21, so that
22 versus 21 is what we're trying to measure in terms of velocity and performance. We really worked hard on trying to stimulate application submission, but they were very consistent this year from year to date. But we worked hard on the application completion to make sure that those students who had entered into some kind of interest and action with us, that we tried to seal those interests in applications completion. So we've seen some rise in admission. And what we're looking at now is active top registration, those students who are signed up for orientation with us. That's a very high likelihood or high probability indicator in terms of their enrollment in the fall. And so as you work through a recruitment cycle, you're working through those benchmarks, but you're shifting from first inquiries down to applications, down to admitted. We're shifted to application, to top registration orientation. That's our primary motivation right now. We will work the entire funnel till the bitter end. But what we're most focused on is those admitted students that we can get into orientation, because we know that that's a commitment.
Ethan, we are up 300 students year-over-year on top orientation. That's a good thing.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling that out.
The TOP stand for?
Topper Orientation Program.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. This is I show you this to show you that there's a lot of consistency to a recruitment cycle. And so this is the last 3 years. And so we talk about 2020 was an outlier. And that's that highest peak that you see in that curve in terms of that accumulation of activity. These are about applications submitted over time. And so you can see that what we can try to do is we try to work to develop this pattern as more robustly, as more enriched as possible every year in terms of our recruitment cycle, but we can plan for the life cycle of a recruitment cycle fairly regularly, just because of the fact that historic performance is fairly consistent. Our opportunity is to work in cultivating, especially in that front half of the year. You'll see that break that takes place right there is between December and January, but you'll see there's a huge rise in activity that takes place in the fall of the year. If you think back about your experiences, or if you have friends and family, their experiences, there's a lot of activity that takes place in that senior year and engagement with the college selection. There's college fairs, there's high schools, college admissions personnel who are visiting. And so we simulate a lot of activity. And then there's some students who take their time in terms of the way they're going to make a decision about applications to an institution. And so you'll see that there's a nice... to use a literary term, denouement, as the way we approach the backside of that the recruitment cycle. But truly, there's still activity, there's still potential. And what happened in 21 is that red line. You saw a lack of attention to application overall to our institution, and that was when we were completely in quarantine in terms of the way we approached the recruitment cycle. And though we pivoted and we tried to provoke opportunities, both in person and virtually with the students, there was kind of a malaise that attended to that recruitment. And we're coming out of that, and we're starting to see a return to the robustness of what we've provided in terms of activity. You saw a great recovery in terms of application volume in 22 in the fall, and you're seeing some lift. You're still seeing some lift on the backside. You saw the greatest lift in 21 on the backside of the recruitment cycle because of that pause or that ambiguity of the recruitment year in COVID, and then some last minute activity when people decided I should probably think about college.
Ethan, if I could add on to that, I'm reflecting on not just the work that I was doing, but the work that other folks were doing in the schools. And so one of the most compelling ways to help a young person understand the decision about going to college is to be in person, convincing them about why, over time, an investment in higher education is in their best interest. In fall of 20, I and Ethan and the entire enrollment staff was in every high school in Warren County and all over the state in person doing visits. We were unable to do that in the fall, I'm sorry, that would have been the fall of 19. In the fall of 20 and the fall of 21, we were unable to do that. And so when you look at the difference in inquiry and application rate, That's part of what caused that. And so we're really looking forward to being able to get out and into the schools over and over and over again in fall 22. Doesn't affect this cycle, but it should change the trajectory again next, beginning again next fall. This may be a little difficult to read the fine print in this report, so let's just look at the bar graphs in terms of their just their representation. What this is first-time freshman historical funnel review admission from admitted, enrolled, and yield. So that top group is the admitted, the middle group is the enrolled, and the bottom is a yield rate. So that's a percentage of yield rate. How many people from the admitted pool enrolled at the institution? And so as you see those five stacks in those blue columns, that's 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, and 2021. What we were looking at in terms of application or admitted volume to the institution, the blue column represents Kentucky. You see this just drop off that we had in Kentucky. 6,700 students admitted in 2017, and we dropped down to 5,600 in 2019. And then you saw the rebound of 2020 and where we are with 21. The introduction of the new scholarship model began in 2020. That was an important aspect to arrest this decline that we saw in Kentucky. And to me, that shows a place where we were under competing with our peers in Kentucky, and we had to take an immediate step to try to change that. And that resulted in both a lift that you see in volume of admitted students, but if you look down at the bottom, that yield rate in 17, 18, 19 was 35, 33, 34, so it was hovering around 34%. And in 2020, jumped up to 39.5, and it was 39% also in 21. The scholarship model changed not only the admission decline that we were sitting in, so pulled us out of that trough, and I think it will continue to do so, but it also had an impact in terms of yield percentage, in terms of how those students were committing to the institution. That second group, that nice ochre color there, that is orange, I think, is going to be representative of our border states. And so we made it a strategic investment in terms of how we could address the proximity that we are, specifically to our southern border, but to the large population centers that are just outside the borders of Kentucky, but within what I'd call striking distance of Western Kentucky University. So this shows also, if you look at that enrolled middle column there, I mean that middle row, you'll see that a nice growth in enrolled students from our border states, and I think that that's going to continue to rise. And you saw that also in terms of percentage of yield, it's at the bottom. It went up from 27% of our border states yielding in 2017 up to 31.9, 31.8 in 20 and 21. This is a conversation both about seeing a return of Kentucky students coming back to Western Kentucky University that didn't leave. But we had a down year last year in terms of Kentucky resident participation, not just in Western Kentucky University, but across the state, across the Commonwealth. And then what we're trying to do with cultivating an enrollment pathway from our border states to help supplement the enrollment in the robustness of this institution. I think that we're poised in a positive lift for both of those two categories, and I think that we can continue to nurture those. I'm going to do a better job of presenting slides to you that you can read in the future. I apologize. What I'm going to just point out to you is that middle line about from the top third of the page. You'll see a large growth of bar graph there, or large bar graphs there that represent Kentucky in terms of Kentucky resident population participation. We had admitted 1,500 Kentucky students to our incoming class in 20. We only had 1,000 admitted in 21, and then we're at 1,200 in 24 for 22. So that's a lift of about 217 students over last year, but still we're under that 500, I mean, we're about 300 behind where we were in 20. So we have some work yet to do in Kentucky, but we're making some better progress in terms of our Kentucky residents. The next bar graph that you'll see of a
of note is going to be Tennessee, which is down here on the bottom quarter of the page. And we're up 74 students over last year in terms of what we were seeing in Tennessee. And this will be actually the largest enrollment over this chart. So from 20, this will be the largest number of Tennessee students coming to the institution for this incoming class. What I think you may be able to appreciate more so is top distribution of admitted students who have registered for TOP. So these are the admitted students who have registered for our orientation. So these are the students who are going to be here this summer and who we're trying to seal the deal in terms of their enrollment for the fall. And so as we look at our distribution across the Commonwealth and into parts of Tennessee and our northern neighbors, you'll see kind of how we're doing with our counties. We talk about the surrounding counties of Warren as the lion's mane in terms of Warren County and in our surrounding counties on the Kentucky border here is definitely our primary market. But we have some really good residents down south in Tennessee in terms of what you see. So that green is going to be year-over-year comparison, either positive or negative. So it's a very cursory review, but to look at each county to see if we're up or down in county. And one of the things I would highlight there is both what you're seeing in the Nashville area, but also what you're seeing in Jefferson County, where we were just this week, and working with those students and encouraging their enrollment at WKU. We were down 200 applications overall in Jefferson County this year. We've been working that market hard, but we're up over last year 10 orientations. That sounds like a small number, but you know each orientation counts, and we're going to continue to work that market. That's the largest county participation in Western Kentucky University, so that's our primary market besides Warren, and we're definitely attentive to that. But I know that as I have become more acclimated to the Commonwealth, and some of you have a greater history with the Commonwealth, you may have a favorite county on the map, so I wanted you to have a chance to see that. Any questions about? One more slide I want to share with you. So we look at backing out of that funnel. So that first slide where I talked about the historic funnel participation, we can gauge kind of effectiveness rates in terms of what our applicant rate is going to look like after our inquiry rate, what our conversion rate is to admitted students, what our yield rate is from admitted students to enrolled, what our confirmation rate should look like in terms of how many of those yielded admitted students sign up for orientation. And so we can back out those historic performance parameters to give us some mindsets, some benchmarks in terms of volumes that we want to hit if we can maintain the same current consistency. So if we think about 39% yield and we think about a 5% melt rate that we saw last year, 7% in 21, but still 39% in terms of yield, we can with some surety think about where our benchmarks are for totals that we want to try to hit. These are just benchmarks, and so where we're looking at in terms of our applications submitted, we were striking at 93%. I don't think that we'll hit 100% of our application submitted volume. But as I talked about in terms of the recruitment cycle, our goal is to make sure that we meet and exceed our admitted student and our top orientation participation. And right now, we're coming up at 90% of that goal right now. And we still have May and the remainder of the summer to seal those orientation participations. It's about 850 students that we're still going to try to realize, but we're up 300 over year to date, and I have great confidence that we're going to meet that goal. So this is our budget goal, and I would love to exceed this. This is my aspiration, and I like to play devil's advocate. I'm very conservative about the way we approach this. I'm not a gambling person. Play the lottery every once in a while, and I won $4 this year. I won't disclose that. But I'd rather work to this to our advantage, and if we're going to play probabilities, I'm going to stack as much as I can. But this is, I'm very optimistic about where we are with our recruitment for this season.
Does anyone have any questions?
I was just going to say, I have a comment.
Yes, ma'am.
That much detail.
Thank you. I can always do detail when it comes to enrollment.
Maybe we should get these after the
fact, because I'm trying to read some of that.
Yes, yes, yes.
Without Dr. Bell making a comment about how old we are.
Well, you know, the thing I think about whenever I look at graphs like that is the demographic cliff that's coming up and what those numbers are going to be like in 2 or 3 years. So the work we're doing now is absolutely critical. And the work we've been doing the last 4 or 5 years with budget and curriculum and all that to position us to weather the demographic cliff that when the students weren't born. So
yes.
We can't be working too hard at this stuff.
Just to ask a real follow-up question.
Yes, sir.
The chart that you had up there that showed the out-of-border state students, if you could, we have some new people on the board. Could you just describe the Border State Scholarship for us again?
Yes. So the Border State Scholarship, our 7 contiguous states around the Commonwealth, we were, when we started the conversation was evaluating how we did what we called previously TIP rate, so tuition incentive program that we had for bordering counties and then various counties that we had identified as markets that we were trying to work. And so it was kind of an arbitrary collection of different counties around Kentucky, in states around Kentucky that we had different rates with. We transitioned to the Border State Scholarship Program this last year, or I'm sorry, in 2020, where there was a conversation about, okay, let us introduce an idea where we're going to provide a scholarship that provides a de facto in-state rate for these students so that the comparison that we have, and this is particularly, the largest out-of-state market that we have is Nashville. And to be within 50 miles of Nashville is, on a national level, half or more of your students that enroll in an institution are within 50 miles. And so when we think about that, that's a market that is a necessary market for the betterment of Western Kentucky University in terms of proximate students to our institution. Now, we have a particular responsibility and role as to educate the students of Kentucky. And I think that we do that very well. And I think that that's demonstrative. But as we talk about shoring up our success in light of challenges that may come from the demographic cliff of 2030, we need to have that market as a sustaining market to help supplement the enrollment of this institution. So in this case, to look at how we compete in Nashville, we are an institution of choice for students who live in Nashville. Their choices in Nashville are Vanderbilt, which is going to be a difficult and expensive endeavor for some students to participate in. There's Tennessee State is in Nashville. So they have those two institutions and then other private institutions that are in Nashville. Is it Bellemare's here. Bellemont is Tennessee. So they have some options for a large metropolitan community that you would expect, two of which are independent and expensive. And then the next contender is Middle Tennessee State, just over in Murfreesboro, that is a regional institution that is a competitor of ours. I mean, we're a matched competitor for both in athletics, but also in academics. And so the opportunities that we present are attractive to those students. And if we were losing out just because of the difference in price.
So I remember when this was presented, I wasn't on the board yet, but I was attending the meeting, and I believe a number was given. I saw about, just kind of looking at your trends there, we were around 600 Border State students, and now we're up to about 700 or so. Some of those would have been TIP students to begin with.
Yes.
So do you remember what the break-even number was on this Border State?
So it was a 4-year projection, and so I don't know the number of enrollees. It depended upon the part of the state from which they came, right? But if you look at the discount rate, and we've gone from per student 7,000 down to 6,500, 6,400, I'm doing this off the top of my head. But what happens is you have to recover the discount with volume. And so we're in the midst of that. What I will tell you is that we are seeing great results, certainly in Middle Tennessee. 100 in an out-of-state market is huge. And so I think that if you look at the way the numbers are working and trending over time, it will we had not had COVID, we'd be in a different place, I'd argue. It will swoop down, stabilize, and then come back up probably in the next 3 years when we transition away from a merit scholarship program that I would argue may have been over-discounting to a merit scholarship program that awards appropriately for the yield that we need. So our yield is going up. If we can yield up in different sub-segments, so does the revenue. And so we think the discount rate this year and next year will recover a little bit, and so the total net tuition revenue does well. The other thing to think about in terms of the competitive space, as much, and Shane, I think you used the example first, and I've used it since, the $20 at Shake and Steak is a real competitor for us. But what's more important is the environment in which we live. We need to have folks talking about the importance of four-year degrees, that over a lifetime, your earnings will be $2.8 million, $1 million more than over not having a college degree, and that we are an affordable option. You know, with our discount rate, we're not just tens of thousands of dollars less than Louisville and Kentucky. We're less than other public institutions in the state as well, for a completely different experience than they offer. And so I think that what we have to do is convince folks of the value of a college degree. And you will remember me saying this, we overlap against the University of Louisville. It used to be 180, we're down to about 118 that choose there over us. Kentucky, we're still about 250, down a little bit, but essentially even over time. 500 students apply here and go to the local community college. 6,000 young people apply to WKU and don't go anywhere after high school for college. Not a technical school, not a community college, not a four-year degree. They go straight into work, some of them. And so what we have to do better is convince the families and the parents and those young people that over a lifetime, you're leaving $1 million of income on the table if you don't make this choice, if it's right for you. And look, some folks, it's not right. And we got to, but 6,000, 10% of them, that's 600. Folks, Ethan and I talk about this all the time. If we converted 10% of that, 600 students, we'd be having a very different conversation every single day. So what we have to do is get not just our messaging aligned, but to be candid, the messaging of our high schools and our policymakers in line with the benefit of a college education. We can get that done. It's going to elevate the Commonwealth, because remember, we're competing against a state to our south. We may have 60% of our students that go to college, you know, after high school. In the south, there are about 80, 90% going on to college. And so if we want to elevate our economy, higher education is necessarily an investment the Commonwealth has to make. I think our legislators got that and get that, but we have to keep hammering that home. That's the win.
Thank you.
Anyone have any more questions for Ethan? Ethan, I'll just tell you, if you need a volunteer to help you in Jefferson County, I'm your girl. So just holler at me and I'll be there and I'll help you recruit. And I have to tell you, the scholarship program, Dr. Bowen, that was put in place, has made a difference. Because I have friends that will call me that their kids are being swayed this way and they're wanting to have a tour. And I have driven up, because I've drug them in there to meet you, to experience the campus. And I try not to tell them how great they're going to love it like I do, because I don't know if they will, but I will tell you how great it is. But it has made a difference with your scholarship program.
And we're going to continue pressing on the space as a competitive advantage. All the Border State Scholarship will do is for a student, please go visit Murfreesboro and then come here afterward. And we win almost every time. We do indeed.
All right. Now, Ethan, would you like to tell us what's going on right now?
Yes, I would. So first of all, my thanks to Professor Young and to Wayne for being here today. This is Department of Theater and Dance, and this is the cast from Little Women. And we're going to highlight this cast today with their performances. This is the highlight of my report for sure. And so I'm very pleased to let them showcase the talent that we have at our institution. But please, would you handle introduction?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, and thank you for having us today. I'm Wayne Pope, Director of
of music and conductor for the show, professor of music here for 23 years. I can't believe it's gone by so quickly. But I just thought, as I was saying, what could we present? How many folks have met their life partner in college? And so we are taking three of the love duets from Little Women today, the musical Little Women, and presenting them. And each one had their struggles. We have Love at First Sight, sort of like me seeing my wife playing trumpet, all sweaty after band camp. She can be that cute. Then we have one that met abroad. Although they lived as neighbors, they fell in love abroad. And then we have one we're not sure why they fell in love at all. But you'll hear that in the duets. And they will introduce themselves and tell them you a little bit about them. So thanks again.
Before we get started, we're just going to go ahead and introduce ourselves. So my name is Autumn Stoley. I'm a senior here on the Hill, vocal performance major. I'm from Owensboro, Kentucky. I don't know if anybody's from Owensboro today. Yeah, that's lovely. A couple things that I do here at the university as well. I'm a tour guide, an admissions ambassador. I'm also an orientation leader. And I'm also on the Potter College of Arts and Letters Students Council. And after I graduate, I'm going up to Chicago to work for the Grant Park Music Festival as an artistic assistant. Very exciting stuff.
My name is Dale Mogri. I'm a freshman here studying musical theater. And I plan to come home for the summer in Louisville. I don't know if anybody's from there.
Yeah.
but I just plan to come home. I plan to come home and visit some family.
Y'all could step forward a little bit.
Yeah,
so yeah, there you go. Just get the TV out of your face. I have the most scary job. I'm running the electronics. Here we go.
Love me as I love you. If only you'll care when we are apart, then I would be rich. I would be wise. I would be more than I am.
Wait for your return. Wait for your return.
Wait while I am gone. If you'll imagine me here with you, if only you'll care if I carry on, then I could be strong.
I must hear growth.
I could be brave. I could be more than I am. Say you love me enough to marry me. I will come home and love you for all of my life. And I will be more than I am. Say yes, make me more than I am.
I am.
My name is Sarah Kate Wiseman. I'm a freshman. I'm a public relations and liberal arts major. And this summer, I'm just going home, and then I'm hoping to work for student publications in the fall.
Hi, I'm Casey Brantley. I'm a junior here on the Hill. I'm studying, getting my BA in theater. I'm from Lebanon, Tennessee, if you guys know where that is. And over the summer, I'm going to be here. I'm an admissions ambassador, so I'll be giving tours.
The most amazing thing.
Really quite a thing.
You tell her.
No, you tell her.
All right. I'll tell her. Under Italian skies,
she was singing lullabies.
She says he likes the ring I see.
The day was ours.
We talked for hours.
It was amazing.
I said I'm a firefly.
I said so do I.
I told him I hate goodbyes.
There was something in her eyes.
I swear the bells began to ring.
We found that we
were so alike.
It was amazing.
So, tell me, who proposed to you?
You know, we were trying to be so discreet about it.
Amazing, there we were in Venice.
In Venice. When he suddenly stood up
and shouted, "Will you marry me?"
It was so romantic.
Then I fell into the water.
Before we even knew it,
she dove in and rescued me.
Happened before we knew.
How could we have known?
Amazing what time can do.
From that moment my heart flew.
We'll be married in the spring.
Whoever thought in all the world we'd fall in love, and yet we did.
It was amazing.
Amazing. Amazing. Most amazing thing.
Hi, I'm Ben Morrison. I'm a senior vocal performance major at Western. I'm from Bowling Green. And this, thank you. this fall I'll be attending Penn State for a master's in music and an assistantship there.
Hi, my name is Leah Schenk. I am from originally from France, and I moved here in 2010 to Louisville. I am a sophomore theater major with a focus in BFA, or with a focus in everything. and I'm also doing a game design certificate. And then, over the summer, I am stage managing for BG On Stage for their Addams Family, and I will be staying here and also doing voice lessons for kids.
I think perhaps it looks like rain.
It's bluer by the hour.
The water falls in little drops.
That's why it's called a sun shower.
Ah, and now it stops.
You are
going to be. If I say rain, then you say sun. If I say yes, then you say no. It seems before we start, we're done. We even argue at hello. If I say share with me this small umbrella.
I say, who cares if I get wet?
We are as different as the morning and the night.
No, we're as different as the winter and the spring.
We always seem to fight.
We disagree on everything.
And yet, you make me smile, you make me laugh, you make me care. How can I explain inside my heart I feel pain when you're not there? Though we are not at all alike, you make me feel alive.
one small thing in common. Love could be like a small umbrella in the rain. When people discover passion, they've come upon something rare. This fervor they have in common will shelter them anywhere. Though the rest may be rough, with such passion to share, I think we have more than enough, enough to make a marriage. If we dare.
Proposing?
No. Yes. Yes. I do not mean today or tomorrow or even next month. In a year, maybe. 2 years, even. I'm a patient man.
I won't be sweet. What beat?
This I prefer. This I adore.
Speak my mind. You can be sure.
I'll be enchanted to the core.
If I say share with me a small umbrella.
I'll save pairs if we get wet.
We'll be as different as a husband and a wife.
Oh, we'll be different as a woman and a man.
We'll fight our way through life.
We'll disagree the best we can.
In the end,
you'll make me smile, you'll make me laugh, you'll make me care. How can I explain inside my heart I feel the pain when you're not there? Though we are not at all alike,
you make me feel alive. Yes, we have that in common.
That one small thing. In common, our love is like a small umbrella in the rain.
Thank you. That was fantastic. You're welcome.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Logan. You know what? That's why I always say I have the best committee. It's seeing performances like this. And I don't cry anymore because every time I see somebody else crying, Dr. Cologne, get watered up. I tend to do the same thing. So, and I have Kleenex the next time so you don't have to get up. Don't get up. Thank you, Dr. Logan. That was fabulous. They are so talented. And oh, this would just save my day.
Thank you. Thank you.
A couple of years ago, I think Western Kentucky University was rated the number one campus in America to fall in love on. And this performance, I think, is very appropriate. But I know George met his wife on campus. I know Lyndon met Ray on. No. Several of us met our spouses.
That one didn't work out.
I got married in this building.
In this building? Well, Doris.
I will say that CJ walked by and said,
"We got together.
What are you doing?" I told you that it was a meeting, and I concluded that we were the third song.
George, I will tell you, Mike Henson and me,
we're third song too. I kept thinking, oh my goodness, that sounds like a conversation we had this morning.
It's great to have students on campus. Jace Lux reminded me earlier today that our forensics team is performing today at the national contest, first time in person in 3 years. We all know they bring home the hardware, so to speak, every time, and so seeing students like this perform and knowing what our forensic students are doing today is amazing stuff, and certainly keeps our feet on the ground and gives us the reason why we're here.
Well, if I can add on to that, I'm hopeful that they will be able to join us at our May meeting. Our concrete canoe team just qualified for nationals and will be competing in June in Ruston, Louisiana. They are another just outstanding representative of our university. Maybe I won't cry when they talk about concrete.
And this is a good time to recognize our new permanent Dean of Students, who's absolutely beaming over there. And for those of us that were lucky enough to be at the academic banquet a few weeks ago, Martha did a great job speaking to that large audience of over 500 people, I'm told, was the tally at that banquet. So all about students, and that's why we're all here. So. Great committee. You're right. You do have the best committee.
Right. Also, she also spoke at that banquet as well. She was the other speaker.
Yes, that's right. Julie spoke at that too on behalf of the sisterhood.
That's right.
And
Opportunity Fund.
And the Opportunity Fund, which is doing better than expected.
Chair, I would point out that, you know, I tell people all the time I have one of the best jobs in the world because of growing up around and being around a college campus is one of the best places to be, between the student research conference, which was a couple of weeks ago, and the dinner you got to attend, and I was honored to get, I went to the production of this play, and there's so many things you can get involved with, and I'd invite the Regents, if there's anything you want to come down, we'll get you in. There's recitals going on, there's other things, so it's a fun, exciting place to be, and it's really exciting right now because the students are coming into my class, and they do, they walk in and they say, I got the job, because they were getting phone calls right in the middle of class that is culminating in that, so to hear those things too. So.
And you're right, I think the Regents get invited to all of the theater things. I know we don't attend as often as we'd like. We're going to the dance thing, which is next week. The theater's dance company will be performing, so anybody that has a chance to attend those, yes, do. Great. Have we morphed out of your committee?
Yes, we have, sir. I'm sorry. My report's finished. Yeah. But I still have the best committee.
All right. Okay. Mr. President, did you have any other things?
No, we'll let the students have this.
I think that is appropriate, too. And since these are committee meetings, I don't think I need a motion. I think I am going to announce that we are adjourned.